The Boy Who Died a Lot by Star-Crossed Girl. Harry's always been known as the boy who lived. Only Severus knows that this is a lie. Or a portrait of Severus Snape in seven acts. The first time Harry Potter died, he was 11 years old. In hindsight, Severus considered it nothing short of a miracle that the blasted boy had lasted this long in the first place. Between ill-advised flight stunts without a single lesson in actual flying, trolls in the dungeons, and traipsing around the castle at night whenever he damn well pleased, no proof does not mean it didn't happen, Potter should surely have shoveled off this mortal coil much, much sooner. The jinxed broom didn't count, because for once Potter's fabled luck had not been responsible. No, Severus alone had saved his hide in that instant, paying for the privilege by nearly going up in flames, for all the good that did. Because here they were, less than 6 months later, Potter lying stone-cold dead on an infirmary bed whilst Severus wondered why he'd bothered at all. What a waste of a fine set of robes. They'd been expensive, too. "'It's all my fault,' sobbed the overgrown oaf who was ultimately to blame for this mess. "'Shouldn't have made him switch teams. Should have never sent him off with Malfoy. Shouldn't have. The rest of Hagrid's words got lost in a fresh flood of tears as he threw his arms around Potter's motionless torso, shuddering so hard it rocked both the bed and the chair he sat on. The movement dislodged the sheet Pomfrey had drawn over the body, exposing the garish slash across Potter's throat where blood and life had drained out of him.
Now, Minerva said, tucking the sheet discreetly back into place. It's no use blaming yourself. You weren't to know that this horrible tragedy, her voice wobbled just slightly on the last word, would come to pass. If any of us could truly predict the future, well, I most certainly would never have assigned this detention. I'm as much to blame as you are. Oh, for the love of...
Severus crossed his arms, fingers drumming against his bicep, and glanced heavenwards in supreme irritation. By the time he looked back down, Minerva was glaring at him.
Would it kill you to at least pretend to have some modicum of respect? For the preposterous pity party you're so intent on throwing? Yes. For the fact that an 11-year-old boy lies not 2 feet from you, dead? For the fact that 3 more children, one of whom belongs to your house, might I add, are sitting just beyond that door?
She thrust a finger toward the room that Pomfrey had led Draco, Longbottom, and Granger into upon arrival,
probably traumatized for life.
Hagrid sobbed harder.
All very touching, I'm sure, Severus said, except that, as usual, you are entirely missing the point.
For a moment, Minerva seemed liable to leap over the bed in between them to ensure Severus's throat soon resembled Potter's. She might well have done, too, if not for Dumbledore's hand coming to rest on her shoulder.
"'And that would be?'
he asked, as though he hadn't spent the past 10 minutes quietly analyzing the information Hagrid had provided before dissolving into a blubbering mess.
"'I am certain you've already arrived at much the same conclusion as myself, Headmaster.'
Be that as it may, I would still like to hear your interpretation of events.
Severus sighed.
1. Hagrid confirms that something is indeed killing the unicorns, some creature unlike any he's ever seen before. 2. Said creature is drinking the unicorn's blood. 3. Said creature has killed Harry Potter by cutting his throat with a knife, a most interesting choice of murder weapon for a supernatural creature of any kind. Conclusion. Said creature is not a creature at all. It is the Dark Lord returned. He was weakened enough to have to rely on unicorn blood to sustain his life, but now that he has killed one person who almost saw him vanquished, we're dealing with a completely different equation altogether. He has Potter's blood. It is only a matter of time until he finds the spell to match, if he hasn't already. How well the stone is protected is irrelevant now, because he no longer needs it. In short, we're all of us doomed.
For long seconds, silence reigned. Minerva's features had shifted from outrage to profound concern during Severus's speech. Even Hagrid was no longer crying, instead, sitting straight up in his chair once again.
"'You know who?' he said, sounding equal parts horrified and disbelieving. "'But it can't be. Mind, never believed all that claptrap about him being gone for good, but at Hogwarts? With Professor Dumbledore here? Surely he wouldn't dare.'
"'Perhaps my presence is not as much of a deterrent as all of us had hoped,' Dumbledore said with a nod to Severus. "'You are certain?'
"'Yes.'
"'Very well. If you could come with me. No, not you, Minerva, just Severus.'
"'But if he has truly returned,
Then I will trust that I can call on you when the time is right, Dumbledore said, with a light squeeze to her shoulder and a smile which, for once, did not reach his eyes. But for now, you can best serve us all by assisting Pomfrey in looking after the children. The twist to Minerva's mouth made it clear that she was far from pleased. Under any other circumstances, Severus might have taken the opportunity to smirk at her, but as it was, he simply followed Dumbledore out of the infirmary.
"Do not look so glum," Dumbledore said as they were ascending the stairs. "I do have a plan."
"A plan?" Severus said. "Are we conveniently forgetting something of major importance? Something, oh, I don't know, orb-shaped and glowing, slumbering safe and sound on a shelf at the Ministry? Something that begins with the capital letter P?"
"Really now, Severus, there is hardly a need for sarcasm. Besides," Dumbledore's eyes narrowed a fraction, "I fail to see why you would believe that the prophecy is relevant."
"Oh, come off it. If it begins by stating that the one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord approaches, and you make it perfectly plain to me how crucial protecting Potter is, then it hardly takes a genius to deduce that it contains further information marking Potter as the only one capable of fully defeating him. So yes, there is a need for sarcasm. We have lost our ultimate weapon. As I've already stated, we are all doomed."
"Brighton Rock," Dumbledore said, and the gargoyle slid aside to reveal the staircase to his office. "Please don't forget that the weapon you are talking about used to be a young boy with hopes and dreams like any other. A young boy whose friends mourn his passing even as we are speaking."
"And whose fault is that? Who gave a bumbling idiot with less common sense than a flubberworm the ability to supervise detentions by taking said young boy to the forest when it is expressly forbidden to students? For that matter, who encouraged Potter's constant rule-breaking and gallivanting about the castle at all hours, granting him special dispensation to join a preposterously dangerous sport, etc., etc.? How many times in the past year did I come to you, demanding that Potter be kept in line and get brushed off?"
"I don't see your point, Severus," Dumbledore said with a distracted air, rummaging about in a drawer. "Ah, there it is."
"My point is that any normal child his age would have seen something sucking the life out of a unicorn and run screaming, much as Draco Malfoy did. Potter, however, was almost guaranteed to run straight towards it, as I warned you repeatedly, except that you failed to listen."
Dumbledore said. "Perhaps. Do take a seat, would you?"
Severus slumped down into the chair by Dumbledore's desk, burying his face against his hand.
"And please, do not sulk."
"I'm not sulking. I'm despairing."
"Then don't despair. Hold out your hand."
Severus complied, albeit with a great deal of reluctance. A soft clink echoed through the room as Dumbledore dropped something metallic into his palm, before sinking back into his own chair, smiling.
"What do you say now?"
Severus stared at the object, all the wind knocked out of him.
"A time-turner."
"A time-turner," Dumbledore said. "Highly illegal, of course, and somewhat dated, but it will have to suffice."
"You want me to go back and prevent the Dark Lord from killing Potter?"
"Yes."
"Well, that should be easy enough. All I need to do is stop this blasted detention from ever occurring."
"No, under no circumstances can I allow you to do that. There is no telling what would happen if we interfered too early in the time stream. It is such a delicate balance, you see. Besides, I believe it is crucial that Harry should encounter Voldemort tonight, just not with this consequence."
"On the grounds that—"
"Call it gut feeling," Dumbledore said with one of those damned twinkles in his eye. Severus's teeth clenched.
"Very well. I shall swoop in, then, at just the right moment, and leap to Potter's rescue like a white knight in shining armor."
"No, you cannot do that either."
"Oh, for the love of—"
"Where were you tonight, when I called you to the infirmary?"
"Supervising detention," Severus said, with a sigh. "Yes, I do take your point. It would be impossible to keep this a covert operation if people can vouch for seeing me in two places at once. Although that does seem rather inconsequential, given the stakes."
"And if it comes to that, that's how it will be. But there's no reason not to aim high. It really will be much better if Harry doesn't see you. As a matter of fact, it would be ideal if his rescue did not seem suspicious at all, but natural, shall we say."
"With all due respect, Headmaster, if you've got such clear specifications for this mission, why don't you bloody well go and do it yourself?"
"Oh," Dumbledore said, reaching for a quill and parchment and beginning to write, "I have always been excellent at formulating plans, but I trust that your creative problem-solving skills will make you a much better executor on this occasion."
Severus snorted. There was no doubt in his mind that Dumbledore himself was equally, if not far better, suited to the task at hand. No, the true reason had to be something else, something he was deliberately obfuscating. Narrowing his eyes, he watched the man write for several long moments, before deciding to set aside speculation until later.
Right now, practical concerns seemed far more pressing than uncovering Dumbledore's ulterior motives. "Anything else?" Dumbledore held up a finger, scribbling several more lines onto the parchment, then signed it and rolled it up. "Yes. As I mentioned, this model is somewhat dated, and as such allows for some compensation of temporal paradoxes, but only up to a point, which complicates matters a little." "Naturally. The basic paradox is this. If you are successful, this timeline will cease to exist, or, should I say, will never have existed at all. Consequently, I too will cease to exist." "Quite correct," Dumbledore said, "which in turn means you could never have gone back to fix the situation. Consequently, the new timeline you'll have created would collapse, Harry would die as before, and we'd end up right back here. I'd send you back, and the process would repeat in perpetuity. We would end up stuck in a sort of closed temporal loop."
"Sounds marvelous."
"Now, a more powerful time-turner can accommodate such a paradox indefinitely. There would simply end up being two of you in the new timeline. However, this one can only sustain the paradox for a limited period. So you will need to inform yourself, past you, I mean, of how you resolved the situation so past you can go back as you did and save Harry. Then,
wait," Severus said. "I was following you up to this point, but now you've lost me. If he goes back in time, won't I already be there, fixing matters?"
"No, because of the paradox. That part of the time stream will have already begun to degrade. In essence, if he goes back, he will then turn into you. The time-turner will facilitate that process, and you will be free to go forward in the new timeline you'll have created." Severus frowned, parsing and reparsing that sentence before giving it up as hopeless.
"I've already got a headache."
"Try not to overthink it too much," Dumbledore said. "It's simply how these things work. Regardless, I've just written myself a letter which will explain the situation so that past me can give past you the time-turner at the right moment." Severus nodded absentmindedly.
"And if he and I, essentially, merge, what will happen to my memories?"
"Based on my research, you should retain the memory of both the original and the new timelines." "Fantastic. More headaches. And actually, on second thought, herein lay the answer to his earlier question about Dumbledore's motivations for sending Severus, did it not?"
"Creative problem-solving. Ha! More like Dumbledore's reluctance to recall the vivid image of Potter's ghostly pale face and gaping throat, the heavy stink of blood soaking through his robes." Severus closed his eyes briefly, swallowing. Staring death in the face when it was right in front of you, continuing to focus on what needed doing whilst standing over someone's dead body, that was the easy part. The memories, though, the way that they lingered.
"You will be fine," Dumbledore said, misinterpreting his expression. "Well, provided you don't go and kill yourself, that is."
Severus shot him a look that communicated just how very far from funny he considered that comment, then snatched up the parchment and left the office.
"Good luck, my boy," Dumbledore called after him.
Severus did not need luck. He needed a plan. Tracking down whom he sought once the time-turner had spun him into place turned out to be the easiest part. There was something to be said for having friends in unusual places.
"Mars is bright tonight," said the centaur, when Severus stepped into the clearing.
"Good evening to you two."
Ferenz turned toward him, one hoof pawing the ground.
"You swim outside your stream, Severus Snape."
Perhaps this had not been such an inspired idea.
"Do I?"
"You reek of tomorrow. By all rights, I ought not to be speaking to you."
"And yet you're still here," Severus pointed out. "If you give me 5 minutes, I can explain what I..."
"You seek to undo what is done. It is unwise."
"Some would beg to differ. Tonight..."
"It is unwise," Ferenz repeated. "What has come to pass shall come to pass. It is written, return to whence you came and abandon this foolishness."
"I cannot do that. Besides, was it not written also that Emily Smith should have died less than a year ago, when I could not locate the star-blooming moss for the potion that she required? Was it not you who led me to it?"
Ferenz's blue eyes slid away from Severus's face.
"That was far different," he said, before fixing his gaze on Severus anew. "Whatever you seek to undo now has already transpired. You will..."
"It has not!"
"You will only delay the inevitable. Mark my words. The streams of time have a way of rerouting themselves."
"Then I will delay it. 3 hours from now, I have no wish to know. 3 hours from now," Severus continued, raising his voice as Ferenc shook his head and turned, setting off toward the trees at a trot. 3 hours from now, the Dark Lord will kill Harry Potter and rise again. Is that a future you wish to protect?"
Ferenc ground to a halt. He looked skywards, his hair shimmering white in the moonlight.
"Mars is unusually bright tonight," he said. "It is written."
But he sounded troubled. You don't believe that, Severus said, striding across the clearing to face him. You never have, and you never will. You're not like the rest of your kind, or you would never have assisted me last year. Mark my words now. I will keep this from happening, with or without your help.
You may find that you do not enjoy the consequences. Time shall oppose you, be in no doubt about that. It abhors any imbalance and shall seek to redress it.
At any cost, Severus said.
A ghost of a smile danced over Ferenczi's features when he next met Snape's eyes. You are persistent.
Can you blame me? You're old enough to remember what life was like when he first ruled. If Potter dies, slain unicorns will be the least of your worries. There won't be a part of this forest, of this whole island, that will remain unaffected by open war. And without Potter, we stand no chance at all. My people will die. Your people will die. All of us will die. We'll have a carnage on our hands. Is that what you want?
Ferenczi pawed at the ground nervously.
The future is not set in stone, Severus said. Not yet, at any rate. Now, I came to ask you for assistance because I find myself in the unenviable position of being in two places at once. If I save Potter and he sees me, word will soon spread and the truth of my actions will be revealed. There is no telling what chain of events I might set in motion.
But one reason why this is unwise.
However, if you intervene in my stead, Severus continued, unfazed, then no one need ever know.
And if I refuse?
Then I will do what I must and accept the consequences.
I do not believe you grasp how far they may reach, nor that you will until you have become as hopelessly ensnared and entangled, and there is no way back. Time can be as subtle as it is persistent.
I don't care, Severus said.
Ferenczi sighed. You ask much.
Much is at stake.
Most of my kind would already have refused you. Centaurs don't interfere in that which is human, nor in that which is writ large in the sky.
But you are not like most of your people.
No, Ferenczi allowed, after a long moment's silence. I have often been what they would call foolish.
Others might call it insightful.
Ferenczi straightened his shoulders, stamping a hoof on the ground harshly. Do not attempt to flatter me, Severus Snape, he said, and there was no humor in his features. I will do as you say, but not for your sake. I will do it because the darkness which roams this forest cannot be allowed to roam this whole land. Now take me to where the boy will be tonight, and then never seek me again. Losing friends in unusual places, Severus reflected as he set off for the location he'd extracted from Hagrid before departing, seemed like a very small price to pay. He did not rest easy until it was done, watching Ferenczi gallop to Potter's rescue from a safe distance, his wand hand twitching all the while. Even then, his sigh of relief was a temporary one. After all, he still had a paradox to attend to. He went straight up to the headmaster's office and handed over the letter without so much as a byword. "How remarkable," Dumbledore said once he had finished. "How truly extraordinary. Never in my life have I—"
"Yes, yes," said Severus, still feeling irritated from having to steal about a castle like a thief in the night. He hadn't done that since he was 17. "Could we get to the point?"
"Naturally. I take it your presence here means you've been successful."
"I don't know," Severus said, spreading his arms wide. "Are there any dead brats lying about that I've happened to miss? No? In that case, yes, I think we can safely say that I've been successful."
Dumbledore sent him a stern glance over the rim of his spectacles.
"Of course," Severus continued, "I may disappear at any given moment, thus spiraling us into a never-ending time loop of eternal damnation."
"Well then," Dumbledore said jovially, "we had best ensure that doesn't happen. Now, where did I put it?"
"That drawer."
Whilst Dumbledore was busy finding the time turner, Severus checked the clock on his desk.
"I won't be in my quarters yet, still supervising detention."
"For how long?"
10 minutes, 15 at most."
"In that case, it will be best if we flew straight through to your quarters and wait for you there," Dumbledore said. "No sense in confusing the house elves by asking them to summon someone who's in two places at once."
"No sense in. You are remarkably blasé about the impending destruction of time as we know it, don't you think?"
"Calm yourself, Severus. It's true that the time-turner does have limitations, but it ought to sustain you for several hours at least. A couple of days, even, I'd wager. It will most certainly uphold the paradox until the moment you originally departed. Was it that early?"
Severus ground his teeth so hard they ached. "No," he admitted. "I believe it was about 4 in the morning.
"There you go," Dumbledore said, beaming. "Everything will be fine. Don't you worry. Do you still have the pensieve which I gave you?"
He made it sound as though it had been a gift, and not a tool he had furnished Severus with after his return to Hogwarts. A tool for the express purpose of getting reliable information out of a spy, for all those times when fear had made his recall a tad hazy. Of course he had kept it. It did not take long to set up the pensive inside his rooms and extract the memory of his conversation with Ferenz. Exactly 10 minutes later, the door to Severus's quarters flew open, and Severus promptly found himself at the business end of his own wand.
"What is the meaning of this?" snapped Snape, and Severus's irritation vanished into thin air, replaced by the joyousness of finally, finally seeing someone jump to a potentially dangerous situation with alacrity. "What does it look like?" he asked himself, already knowing the answer. "It looks like all my precautions to keep my hair from falling into the wrong hands were in vain, because a Polyjuice imposter has clearly invaded my quarters." Snape's eyes narrowed. "An imposter who has the nerve to sit in my favorite chair." "Oh no, your precautions worked perfectly," Severus said. "You see, I am no imposter. I am," he leaned forward slightly, steepling his fingers before him and dropping his voice on the next words, "the ghost of Christmas future." Snape blinked, looking quickly over at Dumbledore, then back at Severus. His mouth opened, but no sound emerged. Severus couldn't help it. He smirked. "Honestly, Severus," said Dumbledore. "No, not you, the one sitting down. Please refrain from goading yourself. And Severus, dearie me, this is all rather confusing, isn't it?" "I'm calling him Snape," Severus said. "I find that helps." "Will someone just tell me," Snape burst out, jabbing his wand toward Severus's face, "what in the blazes is going on?"
"Of course, my boy, of course. Please, take a seat, and please do put away your wand. No matter how trying you find, Severus, threatening him is hardly the answer."
Snape sank into the proffered chair much as Severus had done in Dumbledore's office not 24 hours earlier, or half an hour from now, depending on how one looked at it.
"This is preposterous," Snape said when they finished relaying the tale and what still needed to be done. "The whole damn thing from start to finish. Sheer madness." "You're telling me," Severus said.
Snape glared at him. Severus might have started if he hadn't become intimately acquainted with that expression through years of looking in the mirror.
"I'm not talking to you," Snape said. "Your overly dramatic introduction to this whole farce was completely unnecessary. And yet, you would have done exactly the same."
"I believe we have wandered a little off topic," Dumbledore cut in.
"Quite," said Snape, rising from his chair and walking to the pensive. He sighed. "I don't suppose I get much say in the matter."
Severus laughed, though there was no humor in it.
"Do we ever?"
The look Snape sent him then was far less familiar, a strange reflection of empathy built on shared understanding. It continued to rattle him even when Snape turned to thrust his face into the pensive. Half an hour later, and he was standing beside the headmaster, the sole Snape in Hogwarts, once more.
"Well," Dumbledore said, "that went swimmingly, don't you think?"
The real question is, how will I know whether we've been successful?"
He'd no sooner uttered the words than a wave of dizziness came over him, forcing him to grip the back of a chair to keep from falling.
"Steady there," Dumbledore said, grasping his arm until the lightheadedness passed. "It seems you've answered your own question?"
"Yes."
The twin memories left behind felt nothing short of bizarre. It was a challenge for Severus to keep them apart lest they merge back into a strange sort of muddle. This would take some getting used to.
"I shall take my leave of you then," Dumbledore said. "You should go and get some sleep. You'll need it after the days you've had."
"Wait,"
Severus dug through his pockets, then held out the time-turner, dangling it in front of Dumbledore by its chain.
"You forgot to ask for this back."
Dumbledore smiled. "I did not forget," he said, grasping the time-turner only long enough to wrap Severus's hand around it, folding his fingers tightly over the cold metal.
"You keep it for now, just in case."
Severus stared at him in disbelief.
"Mind you, I only want you to use it for the same reason I gave it to you in the first place," Dumbledore continued. "Time is far too fragile for us to play around with at our leisure."
"Don't be preposterous," Severus said. "Potter won't die again. He can't. I won't let it happen."
"Let us hope that you are right," Dumbledore said, already by the door. "Oh, and Severus?"
"Yes?"
"If you do ever find that you need to use it, there is no need to inform me of the details. In fact, I would much rather you didn't, simply to avoid unnecessary complications, you understand. Good night."
Finally alone in his quarters, Severus stared at the small hourglass in the palm of his hand, feeling distinctly unsettled. It didn't help that Ferenz's voice was stuck on a loop in his head. The streams of time have a way of rerouting themselves. For the sake of his own sanity, Severus hoped he was sorely mistaken.
"He made his way through each and every one of the protections set in place for the stone."
"With Mr. Weasley and Miss Granger's assistance, yes."
"Unscathed."
"Well, Mr. Weasley,
Potter, remained unscathed."
"Yes."
He then encountered Quirrell, who has been harboring the Dark Lord all this time in his very body. And, by the way, did I not tell you that he was suspicious?
You did, Severus, you did.
He encountered Quirrell and the Dark Lord, and in the end he remained unscathed as ever, whilst Quirrell is dead and the Dark Lord himself has fled.
As I said, I arrived just in time. Lemon Drop?
You should never have left in the first place, with everything that had happened.
I know, Severus, Dumbledore said. Believe me, I'm well aware that it was a grave miscalculation. But all's well that ends well, no? Severus scowled. I would have thought you'd be happy that the boy survived, Dumbledore said, especially after the trouble you went through very recently.
Happy? Severus said. Happy? That he narrowly avoided death by scraping by on nothing but sheer, dumb luck?
Oh, it wasn't just luck, Dumbledore said. The fact that Quirrell could not touch him due to— Severus rose to his feet.
Spare me, he spat. Hearing you wax poetic about Lily's sacrifice, his hands clenched, once was quite enough. As a matter of fact, I take it all back. I am happy. I'm ecstatic. Here I was, assuming the worst, thinking that Potter's luck had run out, when clearly he still has it in spades. How convenient that this time Quirrell did not have a knife. How convenient that you happened to arrive at just the right moment. Call it what you will. I call it nothing but sheer, dumb luck.
He slammed the door to Dumbledore's office in his wake. It wasn't until much later, after calm had found him in stages, that the true meaning of his words began to fully sink in. If Potter had his much-fabled luck back, then Severus didn't need to lose any more sleep worrying about his survival, or at least not any more than he had before that disastrous night in the forest. The streams of time have a way of rerouting themselves. Ha! Centaurs knew nothing, because Potter had his luck back, and Severus was done.
The second year. To say that Severus was incensed when Potter didn't even make it to the beginning of the next school year would be putting it mildly.
Oh, but this is terrible, whispered Flitwick, wringing his hands.
Severus did not respond. He was too angry for words. As a matter of fact, he'd been so thoroughly enraged the instant he encountered the spectacle that he'd sent his Patronus off to the Great Hall without thought, when calling for help was both futile and counterproductive. That's how angry he was.
"I don't understand," said Minerva, sounding utterly gutted. "What on earth could have possessed them?"
Before them stood the Weasleys' blue Ford Anglia, its roof completely caved in. No, not caved in so much as crushed into a flattened mass of twisted metal. It reminded Severus of nothing so much as the old scrapyard that used to be right next to the mill in his hometown. They'd crushed whole cars there, too. They probably have loved the Whomping Willow. One thing could be said for it, most certainly. It was effective. Severus had already confirmed with a few select spells that the occupants of the car were no more. As if the slow trickle of red oozing out from the ruined front door didn't speak for itself. Behind them, the courtyard was rapidly filling with people. A female voice started screaming hysterically. Probably Granger. Severus took a deep breath. He pondered as he watched the Whomping Willow sway innocently in the wind, abandoning the first plan that occurred to him. Certainly, freezing the tree at the right moment might appear like the obvious solution, but it was too risky by far. He could neither be spotted by Potter or Weasley, nor provide them with additional information to prompt further escapades. Besides, the damned louts quite rightly deserved a good scare, just not one which saw them permanently expired. He began casting spells on the car, instead.
"What are you doing?" Minerva asked. "Testing a theory." "This is hardly the time."
"Shush," Severus said. "Ah, yes, just as I thought. Enchanted to fly, but not much besides. The Weasleys always did lack imagination."
And with the information he needed under his belt, he turned, striding back to the castle.
"Severus Snape," said Minerva. "Just where do you think you are going?" "To pick up something I forgot in my quarters," Severus called back over his shoulder. "I find I rather need it, seeing as how I'm not, in fact, done."
The crowd parted before him, mixed bewilderment and horror plain on their faces. What a shame that none of the students would remember any of this. the wonders it would do for his reputation. He sat up through the night, crafting the spell, adjusting it until every last flaw had been ironed out. After all, creativity only took one so far. True mastery always lay in the execution, in paying attention to detail. By the time Severus emerged from the dungeons, the sky bled with the pink-orange hues of sunrise. He made his way through the deserted grounds of the castle to a well-secluded spot, and several turns of the hourglass and an apparition later, all around him was dark once more. He found the car in the garage, surrounded by broken toasters and other mismatched muggalania. "You, my dear," he murmured, running his fingers over the bonnet, "are in for a treat. You see, he may have granted you the power to fly, but I will give you a sense of self-preservation." Which, naturally, required a sense of self in the first instance. Bestowing sentience on an inanimate object forever remained a tricky endeavor, and, watching the curls of light he cast sink into the bodywork of the car, Severus had to admit he'd surpassed even himself on this occasion. Nevertheless, he still ran several diagnostic spells, just to make sure that the changes had definitely taken hold. "Don't disappoint me now," he said, patting a headlight in parting. "I'm counting on you." The car did not respond. But that was all right, because he'd designed for sentience to come on it gradually. Any drastic leap in awareness would only confuse the poor thing, and likely lead to erratic behavior, which, in combination with two already erratic prepubescents, would only spell disaster. Now he only had to wait. The car performed beautifully in the end, albeit with an alarming delay. From his hideout, Severus watched it get tossed to and fro for several agonizingly long seconds, fearing nothing so much as that his spell had been a little too subtle, that all of it had been in vain, and that he'd have to loop back a second time. Then the engine leapt into action and his heart started beating again. When the car promptly spat a bedraggled pair of idiots out onto the ground, he damn near cheered. The elation was short-lived, however, morphing straight back to the boiling rage that had held him in its grasp since he'd discovered the wrecked car. That he should have to do this at all, spend hours slaving away over a fiendishly complex bit of magic, lurk about like some common criminal for close to a day, experience this heart-stopping terror. Unacceptable. There was a simple solution to the problem. He'd worked it all out whilst waiting for evening to fall. Potter needed to be expelled. If he was not at Hogwarts, but back in the arms of his adoring relatives, he couldn't possibly get himself into trouble. 11 years he had spent in Little Whinging, and without a single report of danger to his person. A single year and a day at Hogwarts, and he'd racked up more near deaths than the whole student body combined. The evidence was overwhelming. If Potter was not at Hogwarts, he could not find new and inventive ways to get himself killed. And all of Severus's headaches would instantly disappear. Armed with the certain knowledge that the flying car incident finally gave him sufficient leverage to achieve this nirvana, he found Snape and relegated him to their quarters for the time being. Then he swooped down on Potter and Weasley. An uninformed observer might have considered his glee at the sight of their crumbling faces cruel, when surely it was nothing but justified. Dumbledore refused to expel Potter, and Severus felt like Christmas had been cancelled. No, that wasn't right. Severus did not even like Christmas. He felt like he felt pretty much every day of the year. Severus hated his life. Less than 2 weeks later, disaster struck again. He was on his way to the infirmary to drop off some potions when he turned a corner and a small, frizzy-haired figure barreled into him. "Oh, sir," Granger said, and Severus's blood ran cold in the face of her huge, brimming wet eyes. "You have to come quickly. Something terrible's..." Severus was moving before she could finish. Two corridors down, the late afternoon sun streamed through the windows, casting a not at all picturesque scene in a picturesque golden glow. Potter lay on the floor, crimson-stained foam dribbling out of his mouth. Beside him stood Weasley, white as a sheet and still gripping his broken wand with trembling fingers. Severus fell to his knees, but two fingers pressed against Potter's neck only confirmed what he'd already gleaned from the vacant, glassy eyes. There was no pulse. "What happened?"
"I killed Harry."
"Yes, Weasley, that much is self-evident," Severus said. "But how? And for Merlin's sake, put down that blasted wand."
"I murdered my best friend," Weasley stammered in the same toneless voice.
Clearly, no answer would be forthcoming from that end, although at least the dolt did comply with the direct order, his arm sinking down to hang weakly at his side. Severus fixed Granger with a glare.
"Well, we were practicing charms, expanding charms. I'd done mine, and then Ron went, and his wand went haywire, and it hit Harry, and he just keeled over. But, sir, he can't really be dead. There must be something that you can do."
Severus sketched a spell of his own over Potter's body.
"Congratulations, Weasley," he said. "You've successfully managed to explode Potter's lungs."
Weasley whimpered. Granger pressed a hand to her mouth, muffling the sob which spilled past her lips. Severus rose to his feet. He shot a last glance at Potter, then turned on his heel and walked off.
"Where are you going?" Granger called after him. "Sir? Sir!"
"Oh, for fuck's sake."
"Away!"
Severus said, and kept walking. But Granger had already caught up with him, persistent as ever.
"I don't understand. You're supposed to help us. What are we meant to do with the...
Her words were cut short as a fresh sob racked her body. Severus whirled towards her, thoroughly displeased with her tear-stained face. He'd be damned, damned if he was going to waste his precious time playing counselor, when neither of them would even remember it.
"I don't give a rat's arse what you do with the body," he said. "Bring it to the hospital wing. Cover it in flowers. Sodomize it, for all I care."
Admittedly, he did feel a twinge of guilt at Granger's shocked gasp as he strode away, but he swiftly shoved it aside. Hardly his fault that the precocious Bint had memorized the definitions of words that no second year should rightly be aware of.
"Have you gone utterly mad?" Snape said,
when Severus pulled him out of a dungeon corridor and into a shady alcove several minutes earlier.
"I could have killed you!"
Severus pointedly released Snape's wand arm from where he'd pressed it against the wall.
"It was the best way to waylay you."
Snape shot him a dark look.
"You just enjoy pouncing on unsuspecting people so much you don't even care if you're traumatizing yourself." "And you," Severus said, "harbor secret fantasies of being dragged into dimly lit alleys by cloaked men, so stop pretending."
Snape stared at him.
"Sometimes I honestly don't believe myself."
Severus sighed, his mind flickering back to his parting shot toward Granger.
"Me either," he admitted, then shook his head. "I don't have time for this. You stay put and," he waved a hand in the air, "disillusion yourself or something. I have to go."
He arrived at the upstairs corridor just in time.
30 points from Gryffindor!
Weasley dropped his wand with a look of bewildered outrage, and Severus breathed a private little sigh of relief.
"But that's not fair," Potter said, glaring at him. "What for? We haven't done anything." "For practicing magic in a public corridor."
"That's not a Hogwarts rule," Granger said with a frown.
"I know, because I've read them."
"It is now," Severus cut her off. "As a matter of fact," he stepped closer until he was looming over them all, but especially Weasley.
"I'm going to extend it. No magic outside of a teacher's supervision at all for you, Weasley. Not until you've found yourself a new wand. Your present one is a menace."
Suddenly, they were all speaking at once in a babbling mass of noises, the general theme of which still remained quite clear.
"Silence!" Severus snapped. "Are you, perchance, questioning my authority?"
For an answer, he received three quiet, mutinous glares. Potter's was by far the angriest one. Ungrateful whelp. I thought not. In that case, off with you three. And remember, Weasley, if I see you using that wand outside of class, I will confiscate it myself. It was an empty threat, of course. Oh, Severus had cause enough to deprive Weasley of his weapon, but not enough proof in his favor. Even teachers could not confiscate the key tool of a wizard without the rest of the faculty consenting, not to mention the family. As he watched them scurry away, Severus felt rather like this was only a temporary solution to an ongoing problem. But one could hope. "Very well," Minerva said, shuffling the papers before her into a neat pile. "I believe that concludes everything on our agenda, so I officially declare this staff meeting..." "Yes, Severus?" The surprise in her voice was reflected in the faces of everyone around them, and with good reason. Severus had long since given up on participating in staff meetings beyond the odd desultory comment and derisive snort. In his experience, they were nothing but a pointless exercise in futility. But enough was enough, so here he was, clearing his throat and folding his hands before him in a forced attempt to radiate consideration and calm. "I would like to propose a motion for the staff to join forces in order to purchase Ronald Weasley a new wand." In the ensuing silence, the proverbial pin would have echoed like an avalanche.
"That is remarkably generous of you," Minerva said.
"Generosity has nothing to do with it. Weasley's wand presents a clear and present danger to the safety of every last person inside this castle.
Surely you exaggerate."
"Or, at the very least, of every individual foolish enough to step within 5 feet of the boy. Something needs to be done about it, and sharply."
"Excuse me," Septima Vector said, "but what is wrong with the boy's wand? This all sounds rather alarming, and yet, as someone who teaches electives, it's the first I've heard of it. I'd wager I'm not the only one, either." Murmurs of acknowledgement rose from her side of the table. Minerva sighed.
"The situation isn't nearly as dire as Severus paints it. Mr. Weasley regrettably broke his wand during an accident."
"A flagrant disregard for the rules, you mean," Severus said.
"An accident involving the Whomping Willow just prior to the start of term. It's true that his wand is malfunctioning as a result, but I hardly think it presents a danger to anything other than Mr. Weasley's grades."
"Then you're a fool," Severus said, ignoring the way Minerva's lips compressed into a tight line in favor of shooting a piercing look in Flitwick's direction instead. "Did Weasley not lose control of his wand in one of your lessons quite recently, causing it to assault and damage you in the process?"
"Well, yes," Flitwick said slowly, "but..."
"There you go," Severus said, leaning back in his chair and crossing his arms. "We already have our first victim."
"It was only a little boil," Flitwick protested. "Nothing to get upset over." "Why," he chuckled, "compared to the stories I could tell you of years gone by, it barely registers. Such accidents will happen if one teaches magic, damaged wands or not. It's all part of the risk of working with children, isn't it?"
At least three people nodded. Severus wanted to scream.
"I quite agree," Minerva said. "Now, Severus, unless you can provide me with specific instances in which a student's life was placed in danger, it is only a matter of time. Shall I take that as a no, then?"
5 times, Severus thought with an edge of hysteria. 5 sodding times Weasley had killed Potter, and Merlin knew how many lay ahead. He'd exploded Potter's lungs and accidentally turned him into a stone. Then, for a change of scenery, he'd exploded his lungs again. Severus still didn't know how on earth he'd managed to turn Mrs. Norris into a creature 10 times her size, but she'd swallowed Potter whole, nevertheless. And as for the straw that broke the camel's back, Severus didn't even want to think about it, because that had just been unpleasantly messy. And yet, he couldn't mention any of them.
"If you refuse to listen to reason, then for f-" He barely cut himself off, clenching his teeth before continuing, "Surely you'll consider my proposal in light of the impact it will have on Weasley's schooling."
"I'd dearly love to," Minerva said, "but for any expenditure the faculty makes on behalf of a student, the regulations quite clearly state that the benefit to the school at large must outweigh the appearance of favoritism. I, for one, do not consider these criteria met, and I rather suspect the parents of other students would feel similarly. It would be nothing short of improper."
Severus narrowed his eyes. "And Potter's broom qualified as essential to Hogwarts in its entirety, did it?"
At the far end of the table, Sinistra rolled her eyes. Minerva's cheeks, meanwhile, flushed a dull red, as they always did when Severus made a point of highlighting her utter hypocrisy.
"Mr. Potter's broom was not purchased with school funds," Minerva said. "If you feel so inclined, you are, of course, at liberty to purchase Mr. Weasley a new wand by yourself, although I fear Arthur and Molly are unlikely to accept it."
As if Severus hadn't tried that already. The anonymous donation he had sent to the borough had been returned post-haste, alongside a letter stating that Ronald got himself into this mess, and we've told him quite clearly that he is to live with the consequences instead of relying on charity to get him out of it. His equally anonymous letter to Ollivanders had been similarly rebuffed. The man refused to send out a wand without it meeting the wizard first, because it might get upset if they're not its first choice. Short of grabbing Weasley by the scruff and dragging him to Diagon Alley himself, Severus was all out of options, and how would that bloody well look?
"Could we possibly draw this to a close?" Sinistra said.
"Certainly," Minerva said. "All in favor of..."
She was interrupted by the door to the staff room slamming open to reveal a dramatic swirl of chartreuse satin.
"Oh dear," said Lockhart. "It appears I'm late to the party. Or, rather, you were all early. But don't worry, I'll forgive you for starting without me. How keen you must have been, seeing how it's not yet 4.
"The meeting started at 3, said Sinistra, tapping her quill on the edge of the table.
"I'm terribly sorry," said Minerva, with such a straight face that Severus might have admired her for it if he hadn't been busy hating her guts at this moment. "I must have mistakenly given you an incorrect time."
Lockhart laughed. "Never mind, never mind. After all, not everyone can possess a memory as impeccable as mine." He swept himself into a chair. "No harm done, after all. I am here now, and just in time for the main event. You are voting, of course, on the subject of..."
"Ronald Weasley's wand," said Minerva.
"Weasley's wand, naturally." A pause. "But why would you do such a thing?"
Severus buried his face in his hands.
"It is broken," he said. "It will destroy us all."
"I have essays to mark," said Sinistra. "All in favor of purchasing Ronald Weasley a new wand, on the grounds that his current one presents a danger to the student body, please raise your hands," Minerva said. "And all against? Very well, that's 2 yeas, 5 nays, and 2 abstentions. Motion denied." "Never fear, my dear Severus," said Lockhart. "I only abstained because, as it so happens, I know a thing or two about wand lore. I will personally repair the boy's wand, and very soon it shall be as good as new. Better, even."
Severus glanced up, horrified.
"For Merlin's sake, don't. Please don't. I beg of you."
"Now, now," said Sprout, who was seated next to him, patting him on the shoulder. "You seem a touch overwrought today, my dear boy. How about a nice infusion of valerian to calm your nerves?"
"What a splendid idea," said Lockhart. "I happen to make an excellent calming draught, based on valerian, but with a couple of special touches to refine..."
"I know how to make a calming draught," Severus said, rising from his chair so abruptly that it trembled behind him. "I am the potions master."
And he fled from the room before he could call every last one of his colleagues an incompetent dunderhead. Miraculously, Weasley managed not to kill Potter over the course of the following week. On the downside, if one believed the writing on the wall, the Chamber of Secrets had been opened, and Potter, of course, was smack in the middle of it all. Try as he might to pass it off as a childish prank,
Severus's unease only grew. He despised Quidditch. A sport, they called it, when it was nothing but a foolish dance with death. A dance that held him in trembling thrall all throughout the Slytherin-Gryffindor match, and, for once, not on account of house rivalry. By the time it happened, it was already too late. The poor visibility ensured by torrential rain allowed him no chance whatsoever to save Potter. He crashed to the ground in a flurry of red-golden robes, one side of his skull completely caved in. Chaos broke out. Amidst the heavy, hysterical masses, one message rang loud and clear, repeated ad nauseam by the Weasley twins, "Rogue Bludger," and "kept going for him," and "didn't we tell you that someone had messed with it?" And none of this would have happened if they'd suspended Potter from playing, as Severus had suggested the week before. He'd just worked out how to dismantle the wards to Hooch's quarters without raising an alert when the door swung open from the inside. "Severus," she said, yellow eyes narrowing a fraction, "and what brings you here so late in the night?" Severus refrained from informing her that she ought not to be bloody awake in the first place to ruin his plans. He'd been caught. Now it was time to improvise. "I have reason to believe that somebody has tampered with the balls for tomorrow's match." "Rubbish. I ran the usual in-depth check just a few hours ago, and they haven't left my sight since then."
"Somebody will, then."
"Again, rubbish. They may try, don't they always, but I've made it a habit to sleep with the boxes at the foot of my bed. Not to mention that my wards are impeccable." They were certainly more accomplished than Severus would have given her credit for.
"Still," he said, "in the interests of keeping the students safe, a goal which I am certain we are agreed on, perhaps it would be for the best if I kept watch over them for the night."
For a moment, Hooch stared at him. Then she threw back her head and laughed. "I think not," she said. "As a matter of fact, I think I can do without my nightcap just the once. Rest assured, Severus," she gazed at him unblinkingly, "nobody will interfere with any equipment that's in my charge, irrespective of who they might be. Good night." And she slammed the door in his face, leaving Severus fuming. How dare she imply that he might have ulterior motives? None of the other heads of houses would have been met with equal suspicion, and, completely disregarding the preposterous idea that he might try to sabotage equipment whilst it was demonstrably in his own hands, he had ethics. Why in the merry fuck was this concept so inconceivable to anyone who crossed his path lately? He cast an additional net of spells over Hooch's quarters, standing guard in a recessed alcove for the rest of the night. Nobody ever came, but Severus knew better than to assume that the bludger had been tampered with during Hooch's visit to the kitchens in the original timeline. He just hoped he wouldn't have to resort to active participation in order to complete his mission. Flying had never been one of his strengths. Flying amidst gale-force winds and slippery rain, disillusioned but still at the constant risk of discovery, whilst attempting to cast subtle spells to redirect a mad bludger, it was sheer hell. So if, in the end, his aim wasn't quite perfect enough, and Potter ended up with a broken limb, that was simply tough luck. And if Gilderoy sodding Lockhart upped the ante by deboning Potter's arm entirely as Severus huddled beneath the stands, soaked through, sleep-deprived, and exhausted, it only stood to reason that Severus loved Lockhart the tiniest little bit. Right? The Chamber of Secrets was definitely open. Fuck this whole damned miserable excuse for a life. A month slid by uneventfully. Weasley only killed Potter a couple of additional times, but Severus remained far from reassured. Whatever, or whoever, had petrified the cat and the boy could reemerge at any moment. If it got Potter, Severus could hardly go back and save him without any knowledge of what he was fighting. And what was he supposed to do if somebody besides Potter died? Dumbledore might have no qualms restricting use of the time-turner to Potter alone. Severus was less decided.
he barely resisted the urge to follow Potter around the school like a ghost, and threw himself into researching the chamber instead. Trying to separate fact from fairy tale, however, proved just as fruitless as the endless staff meetings during which everyone urged him to watch the Slytherins with a close eye. As if he wasn't doing so already. As if he didn't make it a habit to study each of his students' foretells during their very first week at school, so he would know for the remainder of their studies when they were hiding at something. Oh, most of them would play at subterfuge, and some of them would grow to excel at it, but Severus always made certain to stay one step ahead of them. It was only common sense. Right now, they knew nothing, and Severus knew nothing either. Nothing but an ever-increasing list of creatures and spells capable of petrifying a living being, none of which rang quite true. With each day, the tension inside him wound tighter. And then Potter had the nerve to cause an explosion, in Severus's classroom, no less. Right there, under his nose, as the brat looked him straight in the eye, pretending at innocence he had never possessed whilst Severus threatened expulsion, he couldn't help but wonder if some part of Potter wanted to die. When he found his stores ransacked a little while later, he knew for certain. But as usual, he had no concrete proof. Snape was marking papers when Severus stole his way into their office. He looked up only long enough to scowl.
Again? And what misfortune has befallen? No. Let me guess. A piano fell on his head. Not quite, Severus said. I need to take your place at the dueling club this afternoon.
Snape kept writing.
No. No? You must have misheard me. I need to. I heard you just fine, and the answer remains no. I've been looking forward to this for weeks. I shan't let you spoil it. I won't sit in my quarters like some house-trained puppy when I could be adoring the cut of Lockhart's new robes, basking in the aura of his ever-sparkling wit. Honestly, Severus, a full-blown narcissist, I thought we had better taste than that.
The quill dropped to the table, splattering red ink everywhere.
How dare you! Snape said, glaring at him. Any enjoyment I plan to derive rests solely in the chance to take him down a peg or two, in front of an—
He cut himself off, nostrils flaring whilst Severus smiled.
As you damn well know already!
Severus lifted an eyebrow.
Don't! Snape spat. Dubiously attractive narcissists aside, it takes a spectacularly twisted mind to get off on antagonizing oneself. Pot, Severus said. Kettle. But getting back to the point at hand, I fail to see what your problem is. It isn't as though you won't remember the delights of knocking Lockhart on his arse. Perhaps, just the once, I'd prefer to experience said delight unsullied by memories of you swanning in and ordering me about like a dog on a leash. Trust me, you don't.
Snape sighed, slumping back in his chair.
Not Weasley again. Oh, no, I took great pains to remove Potter from his vicinity right at the start. I paired him with Draco.
And an excellent plan it had been, too, because Draco, for all his boisterous talk, simply didn't possess the backbone to inflict serious damage on another person. Perhaps when he got older that would change, but Severus doubted it. Narcissus's soft hands had left an indelible imprint on the boy.
You cannot expect me to believe that Draco Malfoy killed Potter. Snape said. Of course not!
Severus picked up the quill, brushing flawless black barbs over his palm pensively.
Then how did it happen? If I told you, you would only insist that you had sufficient knowledge to intervene in my place. And I'd be correct. Don't you think it's a little unfair that you're the only one who's permitted to execute plans, whilst I have to memorize pensive contents and retrace every last one of your convoluted steps? Don't tell me no. I know better than that. And it's fair, is it, Severus said, slamming the quill onto the table, that I should have to wait around, cogitating on the last fantastic memory which I could do without.
Snape looked rather taken aback.
That bad?
Severus shrugged, turning his back on him. Farshiel, he thought, as the scene unspooled anew in his mind, that's what it had been. Longbottom's pale, sweaty face as he stood trembling before the crowd. Farshiel. His poor aim sending his spell careening across the great hall, shattering the leg of a table. Farshall. The table leg flying straight back into the crowd and unerringly towards Potter, stabbing him clean through from the back. Beyond Farshall. Lockhart's high-pitched shout of, "I'll fix it! I'll fix it!" and ensuing spell which caused the makeshift stake to explode and Potter right along with it. Preventable, that's what it had been. Severus should have seen it coming a mile off, would have, if he hadn't been momentarily stuck on Potter's wide eyes, the look of shocked surprise on his face as a trail of red spilled over his bottom lip. It had been the first time he'd been present as Potter died. For fuck's sake, it shouldn't rattle him so. "I'll stay," Snape said softly, and Severus felt absurdly exposed for a moment, unused to being read so easily. Ridiculous. What kind of person feared himself? He resolutely pushed away the image of Potter's face, nodded sharply at Snape, and left his office.
"Let's have a volunteer pair," said Lockhart. "Longbottom and Finch Fletchley, how about you?"
"A bad idea, Professor Lockhart," Severus said. "Longbottom causes devastation with the simplest spells. We'll be sending what's left of..." His eyes darted briefly toward Potter. "Finch Fletchley up to the hospital wing in a matchbox. How about Malfoy and Potter?"
Nothing could go wrong now. By guiding Draco through the duel, Severus could remain in complete control, the counter-curse to whatever spell he chose on his lips at all times. He might even be able to work in an additional chance to teach Potter a lesson, in the hopes of discouraging further rule-breaking and reckless self-endangerment. What he hadn't expected was that Potter would start talking to a snake.
"A parcel mouth," Snape said later, as soon as he'd emerged from the pensive. "You don't think..."
Severus shook his head, having already dismissed that idea on his way to the office.
"One of these days the brat will die because he forgot to tie his laces. Does that strike you as someone capable of masterminding attacks with such precision that not a single trace is left in their wake?" "No," Snape said, "but it must signify something."
Severus couldn't agree more, but even between the two of them, they utterly failed to decide on what that something might be. Christmas brought more disconnected shards of the mosaic, a further attack, and a Hermione Granger who clearly knew a lot less about potions than she'd always assumed. Why did Potter need Polyjuice Potion? Why, for that matter, did Dumbledore let him get away with it? Severus wasted precious hours of his life trying to argue the point with the headmaster, and got nothing but equivocations in return, as though there could be any doubt that Potter was the driving force behind Granger's dangerous experimentation. Severus fondly remembered her first months at Hogwarts. She'd been an obnoxious bint then, too, but at least she'd been an obnoxious bint you could trust to obsessively follow the rules. He spent the following months in a daze, research and meeting dead ends, enduring an atrocious Valentine's Day that was only marginally improved by the fact that nobody managed to poison Potter with a poorly brewed love potion, whilst the rest of the school seemed to breathe much easier in the absence of further attacks, Severus felt less inclined towards optimism. When early May rolled around and even deaths by Weasley, a feature of his life he was becoming alarmingly used to, ground to a halt, he was, frankly, unnerved. Proverbs were not rooted merely in superstition, and right now everything was just too damn calm. Perhaps he shouldn't have breathed a sigh of relief when the next victim turned out to be Granger. He did, regardless. He was far less enthused with Dumbledore's subsequent dismissal, apart from the fact that, with Lockhart as the defense teacher, adequate protection for the students was in short supply, a crowing Lucius Malfoy was the last thing on earth he wanted to deal with. He never once believed Hagrid to be the true culprit. Like Potter, he didn't possess the brains. And then, on a Tuesday morning, the unthinkable happened. Minerva reported Potter and Weasley as missing.
"What do you mean, missing? There's a curfew on. We've teachers patrolling the corridors at all hours."
"I cannot explain it either," Minerva said. "They weren't in Gryffindor Tower when I came to escort the students to class. Neither their classmates nor any of the portraits have seen them since last night. It's as though they've vanished into thin air."
She sounded calm and collected as ever, but Severus saw the truth in the tense line of her shoulders, her jaw, to say nothing of Minerva seeking him out of her own accord in the first instance. "I confess to finding myself at a loss," she said. "I'd hoped that you might have some other idea of how to find them before I alert the families." Severus nodded. "I do, as a matter of fact," he said, already turning and walking away. "You needn't accompany me. I shall report back in the event that I am unsuccessful. As if I could sit idly by whilst two of my students are unaccounted for," Minerva said, keeping easily up with his stride. "I'll stay." Severus debated forcing the issue whilst he unlocked the door to his office before deciding it wasn't worth the bother. Chances were she wouldn't even remember this. He found the glass vial right where he'd left it, in the bottom drawer of his desk, heavily warded. Its contents shimmered a deep purple crimson in the light. Minerva gasped. "Is that what I think it is?" "Probably," Severus said, grabbing a silver bowl and crushing 7 rowan berries inside it. Now where had he put the powdered moonstone? "I don't suppose you'd care to explain to me how you came by Mr. Potter's blood?" "Ah, there it was." Severus sprinkled a fine layer into the bowl and emptied the vial over the mixture. "Not really." "Or why you felt the need to keep a 12-year-old boy's blood in the first place?" Severus shrugged distractedly, swirling his wand in a winding pattern through the mixture before using it to slice his palm open. 1 drop. 2 drops. 3 drops. The mixture hissed. Around them, the walls of the castle seemed to shiver. "And is that blood magic you are?" "Evidently," Severus said, and shot her a glare. "Do try to keep up, Minerva." 4 drops. 5 drops. 6 drops. Minerva glared back. "I was merely attempting to point out that it is dark magic. I assure you, I am well aware." 7 drops. "Then you know that I cannot allow you to... Do you want Potter found or not?" "There must be another way." "There isn't. So kindly do me a favor. Either shut up or leave my office. Because, as it so happens, I would quite like to find Potter myself, and I will achieve this through whatever means may be necessary. Reperio." The mixture bubbled and foamed. When Severus thrust his cut hand into the bowl, submerging it beneath waves of red, the walls didn't shiver so much as groan. Books rattled on their shelves, and for a moment Severus felt nothing beyond the sickening lurch of his stomach, nearly enough to make him heave. Gods, but he hated tracking spells of this nature. The only relief lay in knowing that the sensation would be temporary, that the dark tendrils which licked their way through his veins would eventually vanish to nothing. "Well," Minerva said as he looked up, her face a shade paler, "did it work?" Severus lifted his hand from the bowl. By the time he'd spelled it clean and closed the cut, he could already feel the pull. Minerva's insistence on accompanying him turned out to be a godsend. Severus probably could have bested the seemingly infinite swaths of giant spiders on his own, but it wasn't a theory he much cared to put to the test. They found Weasley and Potter's bodies amidst the melee and barely dragged them to safer ground. Perhaps it was the camaraderie of fighting back to back which drove him to rest a hand on Minerva's shoulder as she sank to her knees before the desiccated corpses, her fingers pressed to her mouth. Perhaps some of Potter's insanity had finally begun to rub off on him. What 12-year-old boy willingly walks into an acromantula's lair? The boy was certifiable. And so was he, trying to comfort a colleague, playing at some bizarre simulacrum of a normal human being. He withdrew his hand and left Minerva to grieve. "And that's why I need you to help me," Severus said. The Ford Anglia rumbled disquietingly. Its headlights flashed several times. The bonnet lifted and slammed back down. "I don't understand," Severus said. The engine revved, causing the car to rock back and forth on its mud-encrusted wheels before it fell still. Severus could have sworn it was looking at him expectantly. "I'm afraid I still don't understand." What on earth had he been thinking? What person in their right mind spoke to a car? The shudder that ran through the metal body then was far easier to interpret. Annoyance. Before Severus could reach a similar state of vexation, the front windows rolled down and the radio turned on. A brief hiss of static later, and a gratingly high voice over an even more grating beat filled the forbidden forest.
"No, no, 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 no," it sang. "No, no, 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 there's no limit."
Severus blinked.
"Wait, does that mean no, you won't do it, or there are no limits to what you will do for me?"
More static.
"Oh, I would do anything for love," belted a male voice. "I would do anything for love, but I won't do that."
"Blast it. Why not?"
"I see a line of cars and they're all painted black."
"You are depressed?"
The car bobbed.
"They're out to get you, better leave while you can," it sang. "Don't wanna be a boy, you wanna be a man. You wanna stay alive, better do what you can. So beat it, just beat it. Beat it, beat it. No one wants to be defeated."
Severus stared. Clearly the car took this as incentive to clarify.
"Your cruel device, your blood like ice, one look could kill my pain, your thrill."
"Now wait a second," Severus said. "That's hardly fair. I never mistreated you. I was the one who gave you life."
"I was drowned," declared the car. "I was washed up and left for dead. I fell down to my feet and I saw they bled. I frowned at the crumbs of a crust of bread. Yeah, 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 I was crowned with a spike right through my head."
"And I'm sorry that happened to you," Severus said, feeling more than a touch ridiculous. "But that was Potter and Weasley, not me. I am your friend, and I..."
The radio's volume increased.
"You've got a lot of nerve to say you are my friend. When I was down, you just stood there grinning."
For one utterly paranoid second, Severus actually wondered if the car could have witnessed his anticipatory glee over seeing Weasley and Potter expelled. But that was sheer madness. The car had already switched stations again.
"First I was afraid, I was petrified, kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong. And I learned how to get along, and so you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key. If I'd have known for just one second you'd be back to bother me. Go on now, go. Walk out the door. Just turn around now, 'cause you're not welcome anymore."
"This is preposterous," Severus said. "All I want you to do..."
"You can't always get what you want,"
sang a voice whose gender Severus couldn't even begin to pinpoint.
"You can't always get what you want. You can't always get..."
"Besides," he said loudly over the singing, "you're sending conflicting messages. Either you're depressed or you've learned how to get along. The two are rather mutually exclusive, in my experience."
The song cut off. The car's features seemed to fall with it, if that was even possible for a car.
"Here comes the rain again," it sang sadly, "falling on my head like a memory, falling on my head like a new emotion."
Dear heavens, the thing switched states of mind quicker than the average first year. Which actually made a certain amount of sense, given that it was less than a year into its newfound sentience. Severus wasn't simply talking to a car. Oh no, he was talking to an infant car.
"I'm very sorry you've been hurt," he said, trying his utmost to sound reassuring.
Bizarrely enough, it seemed to come far easier than when he was forced to talk to distraught students.
"It shouldn't have happened. And believe me, I can completely understand any animosity you feel towards those two idiots who flew you into the tree."
"A good heart these days is hard to find. True love, the lasting kind.
Yes, I suppose so.
What is love? Wailed the car, its engine revving alongside the beat. Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me. No more.
I don't want to hurt you, Severus said. He cautiously reached out with one hand, but before he could rest it on the bonnet, a wave of sound blasted toward him, nearly exploding his eardrums. Can't touch this! No, 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 no. Can't touch this!
Make that an extremely neurotic infant car. Evidently, the apple had not fallen very far from the tree.
Sorry, Severus said, then shook his head. Very well. If you're so completely opposed to the idea, I shall have to take matters in hand myself.
He rubbed at his temple, but it didn't banish the headache which had been brewing for days.
As I've been doing all bloody year, he muttered. For fuck's sake, I'm so fed up with this.
He just turned away when the car burst into sound again, a mournful tune this time, the volume starting out hesitant before amping up. If I could turn back time. If I could find a way, I'd take back those words that hurt you.
Severus froze, then turned back. If you really want to save me some pain, he said, then help me. The spiders pose no risk whatsoever to you, you realize.
Silence.
If you're depressed, there must be something you want. Something to make you feel better. Something I could do to recompense you.
You got a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we can make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere.
You want to get away from here?
I want to break free, confirmed the car. I want to break free.
I can facilitate that. Anywhere in particular?
The car rumbled for several moments, as though deep in thought. Then the passenger's side front door opened and a map fell to the ground before Severus's feet. He picked it up and stared at the page it had opened on.
The Arctic tundra? He said in complete disbelief.
Feels like heaven, enthused the car. Feels like heaven.
Actually, Severus said, on second thought, the Arctic tundra does sound rather lovely.
Just wrap your legs round these velvet rims, suggested the car, and strap your hands cross my engines. Together we could break this trap, we'll run till we drop. Baby, we'll never go back.
I'd love to, Severus sighed, but I can't. Who knows what new and imaginative ways of dying Potter will discover in my absence. The world as we know it may well collapse if I'm not here to save him.
The car seemed to contemplate this for a moment. Who's gonna drive you home tonight? It asked mournfully. Who's gonna pick you up when you fall? Who's gonna hang it up when you call? Who's gonna pay attention to your dreams? Who's gonna pluck their ears when you scream? You can't go on thinking nothing's wrong. Oh, no. Who's gonna drive you home tonight?
Severus swallowed. I don't need anyone to drive me home. I never have done, and I never will, he said.
But for some reason, his guts seemed to have twisted into heavy coils with the somber melody, and the words did little to unwind them.
I'm just fine on my own, he said. Regardless, does that mean you'll help me? You'll go and rescue the idiots from the spiders, if I promise to send you to the Arctic tundra afterward?
You can do magic. You can have anything that you desire. Magic. You're the one who can put out the fire. You know darn well, when you cast your spell, you get your way. When you hypnotize with your eyes, a heart of stone can turn to clay.
Severus barked out a laugh. Excellent. I shall meet you here tomorrow morning in that case. You're certain you've understood what it is you need to do.
The car bobbed anew, this time energetically.
Never gonna give you up, it sang cheerily. Never gonna let you down. Never gonna run around and desert you. Severus inclined his head and watched the car drive off into the forest, shaking his head bemusedly as it started up a new song. Snape was never going to believe any of this.
Are you quite all right, my dear boy?
Severus, who had been staring at Dumbledore in increasing stages of stunned incomprehension, shook himself out of his stupor. A basilisk, he said, cursing himself an utter fool. Of course the monster had been a basilisk. How could he have failed to even consider that option? He'd focused so much on petrification he'd missed all the glaring signs, like some imbecilic first year who couldn't tell the difference between antimony and aconite.
Yes, Dumbledore said with a smile, and such an exemplar of its species to boot. At least 25 feet in length, if not 30. I'd be astounded that Hogwarts harbored such a creature for nearly a millennium without it being detected, but evidently Slytherin must have suspended it in a sleep which only a Parselmouth could break. A remarkable piece of magic.
At any other time, Severus might well have agreed, and their conversation would have turned toward the theoretical abstractions involved in linking a spell to a rare gift of this type. But right now, however, he was a little too stuck on other details.
A 30-foot basilisk, he repeated tonelessly, awakened by a memory imprint of the Dark Lord, and Potter fought them both, and won.
With a little help from dear Fox here, Dumbledore said, beaming up at the phoenix.
It lifted its head to trill out a high note, then resumed grooming its shimmering feathers with its beak.
That any 12-year-old boy could display such outstanding valor and loyalty whilst fearing for his very life, now that will never cease to amaze me. Harry truly is one of a kind.
Valor, Severus said, images of Potter's dead body flickering past his mind's eye in quick succession.
Even to his own ears, his voice rang out oddly, too calm and too distant. His features felt frozen. Dumbledore's smile shifted into a frown.
Are you certain you are quite well? You don't sound like yourself. A spot of tea, perhaps, to combat the shock.
I am fine, Severus said, rising from his chair on wooden legs. If you will excuse me, I have marking I must attend to.
Of course, my boy. I should return to completing the paperwork for St. Mungo's on Professor Lockhart's behalf myself. Dumbledore shook his head. A sad, if rather fitting, end. But better him than two pupils. How lucky that Mr. Weasley's wand has been malfunctioning.
A muscle near Severus's eye twitched sharply.
Yes, how lucky.
At least have a lemon drop on your way out, Dumbledore said, standing up and pressing one of the sticky sweets into Severus's hand. The sugar will do you good.
Naturally, Severus banished the damn thing in a puff of smoke the moment he was out the door. He did not get any marking done that night. Instead, he got blindingly drunk,